What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by Senior Reporter Carissa Bell. Hello, Carissa.
Hey, Dev.
Hello, and also podcast producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
RIP TikTok? Question mark.
I mean, we have run this episode, I was looking through our show notes, like, I think 3 or 4 times.
Yes.
The threat of the TikTok ban has been a thing. So, but it seems like it's actually getting here. Like, the current... Everyone's looking at TikTok. Everyone's looking at the Supreme Court. We are currently looking at January 19th being the day. That's this upcoming Sunday is the day TikTok could shut down in the U.S. Because of the what Biden had passed months ago. If they didn't sell, or, you know, if they didn't change ownership to a U.S. company, they would have to shut down by that point. So we are ticking towards that. Chris is eagerly looking at the Supreme Court updates to see if they're going to announce a delay or anything like that. So we'll talk about all that, too. And Chris is the perfect person to dive into that with us. And also we are going to be talking about the moderation changes over at Meta and Facebook and everything. And also, I guess, sort of the weird right-wing downfall of Mark Zuckerberg. But maybe not just him. Maybe it's also, like, all the tech CEOs. Maybe they all just, like, could not wait to jump over to be, I don't know, very pro-fascist at times. We'll talk about all that too, Chris. I'm sure you've got a lot to say. And also this morning we woke up and Nintendo announced the Switch 2. So vaguely, we don't have details. We have a promo video. We have like a short press release, but we'll dive into some of our thoughts on that. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. You can also join us Thursday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel for our live stream. We've got a bunch of folks here right now. It's good to, like, chat with the live audience when we have new devices, and some are coming soon. We can show them off live in our Q&A as well, and you can ask questions. So join us. It's a fun time. Also, stay tuned to the end of this episode for my chat with Dan Erickson, the creator of Severance. We talk about what it's like preparing a season 2 for a show that's highly anticipated after kind of having a surprise hit with a first season. So I thought it was a really good return to form for Severance, so be sure to stay tuned for that. So RIP TikTok, Carissa, can you, like, we've talked about where this started. We've talked about, like, many points I think, like, several folks have tried to, like, stop this ban entirely. Where are we right now looking at the potential ban on Sunday?
So we're waiting for the Supreme Court to give its opinion. This was kind of TikTok's last-ditch legal effort to kind of block this law. We don't know how they're going to rule, but, you know, from all the questions they asked, you know, the people who kind of are good at reading the tea leaves of what's going on, it seems like they're very likely to uphold the law. It seems like TikTok is also expecting them to uphold the law. There's been, you know, a lot of reporting that they're basically preparing that they will have to shut down on Sunday when this law is supposed to take effect.
I think there were a lot of discussions about, like, what that would look like. Some people thought it would just be like TikTok would leave the app stores and, like, slowly degrade over time, but maybe you'd still see videos, but you'd be hooking into servers from another country or something. Does it sound like they're just planning to, like, fully kill it by Sunday if nothing happens here?
That's what it sounds like. We know that at minimum, the App Store and Google Play will have to remove the app so no one else can download it. There was, you know, like you said, the speculation that, you know, maybe it'll continue to work and will just kind of stop working over time. It sounds like from people who've kind of been talking to sources inside TikTok, mm-hmm. that perhaps they just wanted to basically just cut it off and stop working entirely. And you can kind of, like, if you think about sort of their position, that makes sense. You know, if they're trying to build more political will for their side, like, it's probably more beneficial for them to just do a clean break rather than kind of have this, like, slowly degrading app, right, that kind of works.
And also, like, so people have a sense of, like, what they are losing to, and maybe the public will start yelling at their representatives as well. Ben, anything you want to mention here?
Carissa, correct me if I'm wrong, but apparently the thing that they planned on doing was giving you the option to download all of your data. And I think that's all of the data of stuff that you posted, not all of your liked videos. I've seen so many people post, like, third-party possibilities for saving all of your likes. And then also just an explanation of why this is happening. I don't know if it's going to be like a call to action or anything. What have you heard?
Yeah, that's about right. I think we kind of saw a hint of this when the bill was first, you know, going to votes in Congress, and they put those pop-ups in everyone's app that was, you know, saying that TikTok might get banned, you know, call your representatives. And, you know, it's kind of funny because that move sort of backfired for them, because all these TikTok users started calling the representatives, and these congressional offices were flooded with calls. And then, you know, all these people in Congress were sort of upset by that and thought that, you know, this was China interfering with the legislative process, which, to be clear, I think is ridiculous, because this was, you know, Americans calling the representatives, which is how democracy is supposed to work. But I think that kind of like offers a template probably of how they're going to approach it this time. They'll let you download your videos. I'm sure there will be some kind of, you know, messaging in there about whose fault this is and why this happened.
I feel like, it's in TikTok's interest to just be like, hey, we are your friends, right? The sort of memes around this, I think, just show, like, I guess the influence of TikTok in America, like the, you know, farewell from your Chinese spy meme.
Which is extremely funny.
Extremely funny. Very, like, to even explain that to the internet from 10 years ago, I guess you could. It is very much an internet brain kind of thing, but you also have to take in to the fact that, oh, now we're also all very much on this Chinese social networking app. And also, like, there's this weird meme culture, and humor has changed a bit because we've all lived through a pandemic and we're all a little insane, and it's all getting... I've seen some wild videos. I don't know. What's your favorite, Krista, like, example of the RIP TikTok meme?
Yeah, there's that one. I think I posted it in Slack a few days ago, of the, you know, farewell from your Chinese spy. And, you know, it was just this guy saying, you know, goodbye. And then he starts, like, talking to specific people. He was like, Stephanie from Texas. Like, don't drink so much Coca-Cola. And he just starts going through a few, like, random people. And, you know, I think it kind of also shows, like, that TikTok users are so much smarter than we give them credit for. You know, so much of this bill is premised on, like, oh, it's a national security threat because, you know, the youth are at risk of being manipulated by propaganda. And then you see memes like this, and it's like, not only do they not care, but, like, you know, the youth are a lot more savvy than we give them.
Yeah. Not only do they not care, they're like, you know what? Screw you. I'm going to go directly to the Chinese Communist Party and sign up for Red Note.
I'm going to go to the line of propaganda. Well, that's where it's like, it's definitely the TikTok audience, especially the loyal TikTokers and the influencers, are clearly smart and savvy about finding a new home on the internet. Red Note, which is a Chinese app that I've seen described multiple ways, but a lot of people call it sort of like an Instagram meets Pinterest for rich young women in China. It is not sort of like an all-encompassing, you know, video social network like TikTok. It is more like Instagram, but people are on it and discovering, hey, there are actual limitations of a service run by China. Like, you can't talk about things. You can't talk about contentious topics. I believe you can't talk about LGBTQ issues in general. So it's China, folks. Like, it's weird how we're balancing, like, US bad in many respects, but also China's still very bad. And we got to pull back. Like, this whole thing started, too, because it started with
Trump's executive order.
Yeah, Trump's executive order in the first Trump administration. Like, he was really trying to put a, you know, stop to TikTok because he really hated TikTok. And then it ended up being a thing. It ended up becoming a more bipartisan thing in the Biden administration, because I think a lot of representatives, a lot of folks in Congress got this secret information about how TikTok could influence Americans or the potential for harms, things that have never been made available to the public.
That's the sort of thing that even the Supreme Court was uneasy with during the hearing. They were like, well, we don't like the fact that there is, like, secret evidence, but they'll still take it into account. I think that there was also a pretty significant contingent in Congress that was disquieted by, like, all of the support for Palestinian people. So they thought that this was astroturfed. They couldn't imagine that this could be just people talking about all of the horrible stuff that they saw online.
Yeah, I mean, that was always kind of my point, was that why are there, you know, if they're getting, like, if the U.S. government has some kind of information that, you know, the Chinese government is using TikTok to manipulate the American public, then, like, that's something that is in our interest to know.
You should tell us.
But yeah. When these briefings were happening, though, some members of Congress came out and said, well, you know, everything we heard was just kind of, like, hypothetical scenarios, like something that could happen, something they might do, something that pretty much any app could theoretically be able to do, which is wild to me that that's what we're banning apps on now?
That's kind of what we're going with. It's not as bad as sort of like Colin Powell going to Congress and saying like we got some WMDs over there in Iraq, but it is very much like there's something at some point TikTok could do that's bad. It feels, I don't know, weirdly reminiscent of that, although not nearly as extreme. Go ahead, Ben.
And like two or three ban threats ago, we were talking about how TikTok might be paying for the sins of all social media, and especially American social media. We haven't done anything to really protect privacy on an individual American level. I mean, Google couldn't even like depreciate the third-party cookie because ad tech people complained too hard.
Well, Google never really wanted to do it, too. Like, it was the whole, we reported on that story, too. Google's like, hey, no more third-party cookies, but we're going to have this new system for online tracking and privacy. Never happened.
Well, I think that they wanted to own that standard. I think that would have been in their best interest. But then they had to work with, like, their other stakeholders, and they weren't able to get it going because all of these people were like, we can't change all that fast, mm-hmm. or we don't mm-hmm. want to.
Don't want to. I think that's the main thing. Not to say, like, there are certainly potential harms of having a large swath of America being tuned into, like, a Chinese social networking app all the time. We have talked about the sort of, like, Cold War of cyber warfare that is happening. Like, that's been happening for the past two decades between the U.S. and China, but it's been mainly, like, small things. It's like China going in, stealing some files, you know? And the U.S. is like, stop doing that. Maybe testing, like, some utility connections or something. And it's gotten worse and worse, but I think a lot of people are looking at TikTok as sort of, like, the misinformation thing, maybe data collection, although we don't know like how that would be any different than the data collection going to Meta or Google or anybody else, except those are American companies. So, you know, good for them, I guess. Is this in a weird way? Does it feel like Meta and Google and everybody kind of wanted this to happen too, just to get TikTok off the board as competition, Carissa?
Oh, this would be the best thing that could ever happen to Meta.
Yes.
I mean, Mark Zuckerberg has gone before Congress, you know, and said, well, really, the real threat is China. And, you know, talked in, you know, very not subtle terms about how, you know, we should really be boosting American social media companies and not Chinese social media companies, how, you know, we really have to stay ahead of China. I mean, for them, like, this is great because this is their biggest competition. And I think it, like, says a lot that, you know, in a moment when TikTok is about to be banned and so many users are flocking to another Chinese app instead of, you know, Meta's products, which I'm that must make him so mad. You know, but this would be like the biggest gift to, and not just Meta, to Google, you know, all these YouTube, all these like TikTok competitors, you know, because for years everyone has been trying to replicate what TikTok has created, and no one can.
No, well, and it's also like Twitter pre-Musk had Vine. And TikTok very much feels like the offshoot of Vine and everything. And TikTok itself, wasn't it? It was like a music sharing type of thing.
Started as Musical.ly.
Musical.ly,
yeah. But Vine had like a really vibrant community, and that was really, really short form videos. But people were using it for comedy, like really making fun little sketches that were infinitely repeatable. And people really started to play with that format too. So you could kind of make these endless loops of skits, sort of. And they just killed it because it wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah, you know? It got popular to the point where even in like 2019 or so, people were watching compilations of Vines from like 3 to 4 years ago. And I've seen people on TikTok now speculate that we might be watching TikTok comps in the future. I hope it doesn't get to that because I am a big proponent of TikTok. I think it's great. Yes, it does put you in a filter bubble, but it puts you in a very supportive filter bubble. 90% of the comments I've ever seen on TikTok have been positive to neutral. Where do you see that on the internet? Where you have comments supporting the person who made the video? It was a companion to me during the pandemic, and I feel like I'm going to be losing a lot of really familiar faces if this app goes away.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people double post to like Instagram Reels and everything, but sort of going from hopping around TikTok to hopping into Instagram Reels feels like such a weird whiplash of like the content you're being served, because then all of a sudden I'm seeing more ads, I'm seeing more junk and more stuff that is weirdly targeted to me because your specific ethnicity or your family comes a certain place. Like, I see a lot of like Caribbean comedy and West Indian comedy via Instagram Reels. That never really hits me on TikTok. It's also not something I like actively seek out. But Meta has this very basic information about where I came from and my like family social network. So like, you like this content about West Indians. And I'm like, okay, I mean, it's fine, but I'd like to see the rest of the world, please. Meta's algorithm seems like it still cannot compete with whatever the hell like TikTok has figured out in terms of recommending videos to people.
No, it really can't. And they like, they do that thing that Instagram is so good at where it's still, they're good at kind of serving you sort of like addictive content, you know, to keep you... Yeah. Keep scrolling, but it's not interesting. Like, I find the same thing. It doesn't like delight you in the same way that TikTok does. You know, TikTok also, for better or worse, there's a lot of like news content on there. I have so many friends, you know, even my age, not, you know, Gen Z, who tell me that they find out a lot about, you know, the news from TikToks and like watching TikTok and watching people break down the like news stories of the day. And, you know, I think that matters. You can criticize kind of the media literacy component of that, but I like, this will be like a new source. This is a platform where people kind of break down what's going on in the world.
And Meta has really been like, no news, good times, happy times. Like, that was the vibe with Threads. But I feel like that was always the vibe with Instagram too, right? Like, I never really saw those news recappers doing much on Instagram. News organizations would like post pictures of their stories and stuff. You can't even post links in Instagram, right? Like, that's why link in bio became a thing.
Yeah.
Because Meta's so terrified of people leaving its platform to be informed by the internet that you can't even post a link in your stuff, in your descriptions and everything.
And it was so weird that for so long, like, only a certain number of people had a link in bio. Like, I think you needed to be a verified user on Instagram to put a link in your bio, and they only reversed that within the last couple of years.
I hate that. I've stopped using those services much, you know, in the past few years, but especially after Zuck's turn and kind of seeing where all this is headed now, it is truly disappointing. It's sort of also like the difference between Threads and pretty much other microblogging services. Threads even versus Twitter, or Threads versus Blue Sky or something, and how that stuff is just empty calories. They're so excited to add AI people into those conversations, so you're just getting useless AI chatter amidst everything else, and it's like, yeah, we're just really going down a dark path here. Anything else you want to add, I guess, Carissa, as we're looking towards TikTok? Definitely keep an eye on Engadget for Carissa's updates on all this stuff. But your thoughts, Carissa, at this point?
Just that it seems like even if it does get banned on Sunday, we shouldn't necessarily expect that to hold up for very long. It seems like this ban has now become a hot potato where nobody really wants to take ownership of it. NBC News had a story last night that the Biden administration, which pushed for this ban, is now looking for ways to delay it. Ed Markey in Congress, who also voted for this ban, by the way, now has a bill to, you know, extend the deadline. Trump wants to save TikTok. So it seems nobody, like, actually in a position of power and responsibility wants to touch this or take ownership of the fact of, you know, taking away TikTok from the American people. So
because nobody wants this aside from the politicians mainly, and not even like security professionals are saying this is the best path to securing information in America.
Well, and it's a slippery slope toward, you know, banning other things. But I'm not sure what the like mass move to Red Note, if there is that much of a mass move, how that figures in too, because it's the idea of like, oh, darn, are we just going to end up playing whack-a-mole? Maybe it's just better to have everyone on TikTok.
Potentially. Like, yeah, what is the end game for the Red Note fad, Carissa? Because I don't think it's going to end well, especially as people see how strong moderation there is.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of these apps that kind of go viral overnight, like it'll end up being a blip. You know, it'll have its moment where, you know, everyone's kind of like flocking there because there's, you know, driven by the news cycle and everyone kind of has a reason, but, you know, it's hard to use. The app is in Mandarin. I was even just trying to sign up. I was having a lot of issues. I think
it was
overloaded. I couldn't even get the like confirmation text for several hours. You know, so I think like this probably will end up like not being like a long-term thing that we're using. I'm, you know, willing to admit that maybe I'm wrong about that, and we're all like going to learn Mandarin. Duolingo said that there was like a huge uptick in
I'm sure
people signing up for
That is one of the hardest languages to learn, especially if you're already like a native English speaker. Like, it's so hard.
Apparently, Duo the Owl is like, oh, so now you want to learn Mandarin?
Duo's too sassy. I can't. Duo's like always up like, hey, I haven't seen you in a while.
But like, let's
you
take
don't launch the app in a week.
Let's just take 1 second to talk about how fascinating it is that we've built a like portal directly from Chinese citizens to American citizens. And everything that I've seen so far is that those interactions are also very, very civil. Like, yes, we might be using Google Translate to be able to talk to each other, but it's mostly just like, you know, hi, Americans, hi, Chinese people. I've seen some people, like this one video of a trans person who posted on Red Note, and there were some comments in Chinese of like, you know, you're ugly, whatever. And then there were just a bunch of people responding to that one person saying like, why do you need to be rude? Like, these are our new friends. That's so wholesome.
It's so wholesome.
It is. It's wholesome for now. I wish the sort of dream was like, is this how we infiltrate the Great Wall? You know, is this how we really get into like China's restrictive internet ecosystem? It's not. It's not at all. But it is a fun, I guess, like this is the year and this is the timeline of like, I guess sort of like the dumbest things tend to be happening. Like the U.S. government was like, oh, no, China app, bad, going to influence people. And then American citizens are like, I'm going to go right to China. I'm going to go right and get, you know, take from the drip feed of their, their services.
Yeah.
It seems hilarious. Seems kind of ironic to me. Carissa, to what you were saying, it seems like nobody's trying to own this. I do think the Trump administration would love to like kill this ban because then they end up looking like the good guys. And that ends up, people will forget the history. Like literally people forget what happened 4 years ago when Trump was leaving office. Like people forget history, but they'll remember of what good he did for them, and he'll take that and run with it.
Yeah, I mean, during the election, people were saying like, oh, if Trump gets elected, does that mean we get more stimulus checks? There's so much more to talk about when it comes to the TikTok ban. We don't know whether or not there's going to be a decision coming out today or in the next couple of days, but please stay tuned to Engadget.com for more news. Email us about any feelings you have at podcast@Engadget.com.
Let's move on to like the news around Meta and Mark Zuckerberg and his whole attitude change. Last week, while we were all at CES, we saw the news that Meta was getting rid of third-party fact-checkers, which was a system they implemented to sort of police, you know, I don't know, fact-checking on their platforms. But I've read from a lot of people that it never really worked well. Carissa, can you break down, you know, what's happening here? What's actually changing when it comes to content moderation on Meta platforms?
Yeah, there's a couple things that he announced. The one that he kind of led with that's gotten a lot of attention was, like you mentioned, the end of fact-checking. And that was a program that they introduced after Trump's first election in 2016, when there was, you know, a lot of concerns about misinformation being a threat to democracy. This was after, you know, those stories about Macedonian teenagers running content farms on Facebook that, you know, had all these just incredibly viral, incredibly fake stories about the election. So they implemented this fact-checking program that essentially demotes content that's rated as false by their partners. That's gotten a lot of blowback from Republicans over the years, in particular. I mean, I think probably on the left a little bit too, but mostly from the right. So Zuck came out and said, you know, we're getting rid of that. The fact-checkers are too biased. You know, we were sort of pressured into doing this by the legacy media. So they're getting rid of that. And then on the other hand, the other changes, and I think these are going to be way more consequential, was that they're basically loosening their content moderation standards in specific areas, particularly like conversations about LGBTQ people, immigration. You know, that, for example, you can there's now moderation guidelines that say you can use like dehumanizing language about people that was previously banned. You can say that you know, you can say LGBTQ people have a mental illness and, you know, horrible things like that. And Zuckerberg has said that the justification that he's used is saying, well, you know, people in the public sphere are saying these things, i.e. certain people in Congress. So therefore, you should be able to talk about it on Facebook.
What a let me just take a pause here and like, what a spineless slug this guy has like become. And I guess he always kind of was that. Like, these folks tend to lean into the political winds, but he particularly is really leaning into the oncoming Trump administration as an opportunity to be very, very friendly to fascism. Like, really, this is reminding me of the stories that we don't really talk about much right now. But I'm thinking of, like, the companies that really bent over backwards to work with, like, Nazi Germany and things that we don't. IBM. IBM powered the databases that were being used to track Jewish citizens in Nazi Germany. What else? Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola broke a trade embargo and created Fanta to sell to Nazi Germany. Like, these companies will, it's all about the dollar. It's all about, like, you know, just continuing to be successful and make a profit. But there's so little, like, moral, I don't know, judgment happening here. And it feels even worse for something like Facebook, which is so in, like, so much of our communication is going over Facebook platforms. It is just terrifying. So I don't know, like, how are you feeling about Zuck at this point, Carissa?
I mean, it's, you can look at it as, like, blatant opportunism. There's also, there's been, you know, some reporting about, you know, Zuck's beliefs and that he's kind of, like, a lot of people, powerful people in Silicon Valley has kind of moved to the right and has been, you know, radicalized by, you know, post-COVID policies and stuff like that. I think that there's also kind of this thing, like, I saw this good point that Dave Wilner, who was like an early Facebook official, he wrote Facebook's first hateful conduct policy in like 2009. He did a great thread on Blue Sky where he basically made the point that this policy seems completely designed so that Meta won't have to action the accounts of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who are, you know, constantly saying hateful things and breaking their rules and then crying about, you know, being censored by Facebook. That if you look at it, this whole policy just seems completely architected to, you know, not have to punish those people anymore. And, you know, I think that that says a lot. Like, he, you know, Zuck has obviously, like, made it clear where, you know, where he stands on these issues. But, you know, I think he also looks at what, how the Biden administration treated Meta. And, you know, Joe Biden said that misinformation on Facebook was killing people. And, you know, I think that really had, like, a big impact on him. And he's like, well, why work with the left anymore? Because they're never going to like us. So we know what the right wants.
You are making me face the consequences of my actions. This hurts my feelings. Therefore, you're making me a fascist. I'm sorry. This is, it is actually kind of sad to see. There are comments from a lot of people who have worked at Facebook that basically define Mark Zuckerberg as somebody who is incapable of taking responsibility for anything he's really done. And the sort of thing where he says, like, he's done apologizing, where that kind of fell into his whole new glow up, his, like, surfer bro glow up with the chain and the Caesar shirts and everything. He's a lot more chill now.
That's not a glow up. He's still a dork if he's got
still a dork
Latin on his shirts.
You know, he's a cool dork. He's a billionaire dork, but still a dork. But that whole vibe shift kind of came where you're just like, yeah, I'm just not going to worry about these consequences of my platforms or whatever. Like, he's not thinking about the impact of Meta and Facebook and Instagram when it comes to news and certain communities. He is all about, like, let's build the metaverse. Let's build weird VR stuff. Like, his whole focus totally ignores, I don't know, the actual impact of his platform. So
it's not even the metaverse now. It's just like, let's put AI nonsense. Let's have AI characters on Facebook. When
it's part of the metaverse.
Yeah,
it
but
is.
Could
yeah.
that just be a cover for, like, all of the fake accounts that are already on Facebook?
I mean, it probably is. I know you wanted to. You wanted to, like, talk about some aspects of this, Ben. I know you had a lot of notes from last week. We were initially going to bring this all up because this news is from last week. But things have changed, too. Like, let me see here. We saw news that Facebook is planning to lay off an additional 5% of workers. That dropped a couple days ago. They were working really hard. Facebook, Meta in general, is working hard to block links to PixelFed, which is the federated AT protocol photo sharing site. It's been blowing up, but conveniently, they were not allowing people to link to it. I think the response was that those links were blocked by mistake, right? I think that's what they said.
Yeah, the kind of typical response was an error. We fixed it.
Whoops.
No explanation.
Whoops. I'm sorry you noticed that we blocked this competitor. PixelFed, by the way, looks really great. It looks really clean. It reminds me of when Instagram first launched. It was just like the four startup guys, and I would have to email them about news and say, this is a cool photo sharing site. Very much reminiscent of that. Have you spent any time on it, Carissa?
Yeah, I've been sort of following it since I started covering kind of the ActivityPub universe, because I think that's been a really kind of underappreciated project. We always hear about Mastodon, but PixelFed is good. And like now the apps just came out finally. And like you said, they're really clean. They have good design. It really feels kind of like old school Instagram. But also because it is on ActivityPub, I mean, you can share that stuff really easily to like Mastodon and other Fediverse sites. So like there's some really cool interoperability there. Definitely worth checking out, especially if you're kind of over Meta and want to, you know, find other alternatives. It's a good one. The same developer who made PixelFed also has a TikTok Fediverse competitor called Loops.
All right.
I haven't been able to check that out yet, but
this is the future. We're just going to rebuild the entire internet in a federated, more open way, without all these countries behind you, I guess. That's cool. Have you seen Loops yet? Because I remember I saw the stories that was happening. Yeah.
I haven't checked it out yet, but it seems... I know he's like looking for donations. He's basically one guy trying to like stand up all these, you know, big federated versions of like these huge services.
It's kind of great though. Like we used to talk about like we miss the old internet. We miss the days of like forums and blogs and like when you kind of owned your own stuff. And the whole thing about the federated platforms is that you kind of own your own profile and your content, and it can be reshaped and tied to in many different forms, but also tied across other services. And you'll be able to jump to different services easily rather than having like all your Instagram data being tied to Instagram. Very cool. Seems like that future of the internet is happening, but it has to be crowdfunded. You know, maybe some rich people are going to help out, but I don't know where that's going to go. Anything you want to add about the Meta stuff, Ben? Because you had a lot of thoughts.
I did.
I just want to know if you want to call out any of these.
Yeah, I did have a lot of thoughts, and we talked about a lot of it. Carissa was very correct in saying that, like, Zuck's video was really like a targeted ad for congressional and White House Republicans. But it's also kind of weird how he said that he's like moving moderators from California to Texas with the idea that they were going to be less biased in Texas.
Yeah.
Because there was reporting saying that they already had moderators living in Texas, like hired through third-party firms. So it might be one of those things where they were really just trying to like get some good boy points out of the incoming administration that they're already doing.
It's all brown nosing. Like everything he's doing is brown nosing. And everyone is kind of doing this. Like all the big companies have donated to Trump's inaugural campaign. That includes Apple.
Yeah.
That includes Tim Cook, who had lunch with Trump and J.D. Vance, I think, this week. So these companies are all just doing what they can to survive. But I think Zuck is kind of going above and beyond to like really prove how useful he is and what a great little lackey he is.
Yeah, let's talk about why that is. So we've got the FTC antitrust case that started under Trump, and they're trying to roll back the acquisition of Instagram that happened 12 years ago, and also WhatsApp that happened 10 years ago. And Biden just kept that going because, hey, it might actually be a good idea. Maybe he or some of his advisors, I'm talking about Biden's advisors, had some conversations with Lina Khan, and she was like, yeah, why don't you keep this going? But now Zuck is like, oh no, like the train has not stopped. It actually is going to court in a few months if it doesn't get like dropped by the FTC under this new administration. So he probably really wants to do that.
That's actually a really good point, Ben. But also, I think even without like Zuck's brown nosing, like that will probably happen, right? Because the whole goal of like the new administration is screw regulatory approval, screw regulations,
absolutely,
screw these like these actual entities. Carissa, on your end, have you gotten a sense of like how the Trump administration would treat this particular case, or just I guess the FTC's like power to regulate companies in general?
Yeah. And just to add to Ben's good list right there, Trump also threatened to throw Mark Zuckerberg in jail.
Yeah.
During the campaign.
I remember that.
Like underestimate just the like pure self-preservation aspect to all this.
I think it's so much self-preservation because how else are you going to put yourself at the top of someone's good boy list if you don't like make this big show of changing all of the policies of your very big social media platform?
And in terms of like how they're going to treat these tech companies, I mean, I think it's a given that they're going to be a lot more friendly, anti-regulation. We can also just look at who they are tapping. You know, Elon Musk, who's like the biggest anti-regulatory crusader, at least like the most vocal one, you know, is like a key Trump advisor. And, you know, whether or not Doge is going to amount to anything, we know he has a lot of influence. You know, Mark Andreessen, you know, you can go down the list. There's all these like kind of Silicon Valley like techno libertarians who are playing like key roles in advisors or, you know,
the entire All In podcast goes to Washington.
This is true. I also didn't realize how many of those folks were basically from South Africa who were raised in that environment, including I did not know Peter Thiel was South African. And it all kind of clicks now. It's like, oh, you were raised in that environment of just complete apartheid. And okay, I guess this is how you see the world.
Like,
this
are they nostalgic for hierarchy? Man, couldn't be.
Man.
Did you catch his Financial Times op-ed?
Yes. Really, really tough to read. Like, very, very much like, you know, dumb guy, but with, you know, a lot of money energy in that. Because it's so incoherent. He doesn't really know what he wants to say, but, you know, he's mad about changing progressive values and whatever. What were your thoughts on that, Carissa?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just shows, like, how, you know, Peter Thiel's usually somebody who's, like, a little bit more, like, in the background and perceived as kind of, like, pulling the strings. Bob, you know, we know that, like, he was a big early booster of J.D. Vance, you know, before he ran for Senate. And I think this is kind of like him. It felt like to me like it was kind of him, like, bragging a little bit about, like, his influence and, you know, how...
You know,
how, like, much power, like, his people, like, in his sphere now have. Like, it kind of just felt like him showing off. I mean, the stuff he was saying was ridiculous, but... You know, and then the funny thing was that got me was the little disclosure at the top that just said that he was like a technology entrepreneur and investor, which I'm like, that is a quite an undersell of a disclosure.
He's just a killer humble yeoman, Walker,
you know?
Yeah.
He has many things, this man. Go ahead.
So, Carissa, I did want to bring up one last very funny thing. You heard about how Zuck might have been annoyed about his own website's policies because his knee surgery picture didn't do numbers, right? Do you want to talk about that or should I?
Yeah, so there was some reporting. I forget who reported this originally.
Wall Street Journal, I think.
Wall Street Journal, yeah, thank you. And they said that he, you know, became upset about Meta. Meta had this policy around like health information not being able to go viral, you know, that I think was stemming from like a lot of the COVID and anti-vax policies. And when Zuckerberg tore his ACL, he had surgery. He posted this, you know, photo in his hospital bed post-surgery, and I guess it didn't get as much engagement and likes and everything as he had hoped, or like as he expects his post to do. And then, you know, he got mad. He looked into it. He found out it got caught up in this kind of like viral health information policy. And, you know, I think what it shows too is like, you know, we should never underestimate like how much of an impact it has on these guys. We saw the same thing with Elon Musk, to just kind of have this like instantaneous, like massive amount of engagement with all of their content. Like, I think that really does break their brains a little bit. You know, we've seen this with Elon Musk, like he's changed the X algorithm when like his posts don't do the numbers that he wants. And I think it just like shows like how much these people's like egos are really like caught up in just kind of having like, you know, anytime you post anything at all, you get a million, you know, likes and comments and all these things like right away.
That's like, your value. That's your value as a person, as a human being. You are somebody who millions of people like. I think that's what they're getting from it.
I mean, it does do something to you. Like, have you ever had, you have a tweet or something that goes like insanely viral where you're just like constantly seeing like number go up and comment and comment, comment, comment. Like, it's like, it doesn't matter if it's positive or negative. Like, it does something like
good.
Yeah. Like, you get that. You're like, keep checking it. Like, I've had that experience. Like, it's not to live
in that environment all the time would be brain breaking.
It's not normal.
It's not normal. Also, like, just the way these guys react to a little bit of criticism, a little bit of mocking, like people making fun of them. Like, so many people are basically tracing Trump's run for presidency back to when, you know, Obama was basically making fun of him at the White House press dinner, right? So these small moments that really just like flip people and make them really committed to proving you wrong. I guess it's a whole thing. All right. We're going to be coming back to this story for sure. Anything you want to add as we wrap this up, Carissa, when it comes to Meta's moderation changes?
Just that I think the big thing to watch will be how they roll this out globally. Right now, a lot of this stuff is US only, which I think says a lot about, you know, who this is for and who, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is trying to please. But, you know, there's a reason why these policies exist. They have big consequences. You know, we saw that misinformation and hate speech on Facebook once helped incite a genocide in another country. And like, that's, you know, something we shouldn't like underestimate the impact that Meta's platforms can have in these places. And, you know, I think for now they've said that they only are planning on rolling back fact checking in the US. But, you know, if and when they do start doing this in other places, I think, you know, we should really be careful to kind of watch like how that plays out, because, you know, history has shown us there could be huge consequences there.
Also, keep an eye on Brazil. Brazil immediately hit back to Meta saying like, what do you mean no fact checking?
All right. Let us know your thoughts on this. podcast@engadget.com. Let's move on to some other news real quick. And the thing we really got to talk about is, hey, of all the important stuff happening, you know, in the world and in content moderation news, Nintendo announced the Switch 2. They finally did it. After so many rumors, after lots of leaks from case manufacturers, that was going around CES. And we were like debating like how closely we would cover that. But yeah, it looks like the rumors were true. It's a slightly bigger Switch. It looks like a Switch with a bigger screen, slightly bigger Joy-Cons.
Kind of looks like a Wii U.
I don't think Nintendo ever wants you to utter those words, Ben.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
It does kind of look like the size of a Wii U, sort of. Yeah, except much, much thinner. Big difference is the Joy-Cons connect magnetically rather than going down sliding rails. And the sliding rails sucked. Like, within the first week of me using a Switch, like the sliding rail just like stopped halting it in the proper place. It would just like fly off while you're playing a game. Glad to see that change there. We have very little details. There is a Nintendo Direct coming April 2nd that is going to have more of the actual information about this, about pricing and whatnot, and actual power and everything. One little tidbit that people found is it looks like within the Joy-Con, like along the sensor array, it looks like there's an optical sensor there. And people are thinking, can you just like take that Joy-Con and kind of use it as a mouse? Can you like roll it along a flat surface and have some fine-tuned operations there, which would be really useful for a game like Mario Maker, where you're like really trying to fine-tune like where you put blocks and everything? So I think that's kind of interesting. Everyone is speculating about that.
They did show that as a possible use case in the video. You know, they had a Joy-Con like racing along what looked like a table. And I'm thinking that that is pointing in that direction.
Which would be a weirdly weird this is why I kind of love Nintendo, of like doing the weird swings. Like, nobody expected the Wii. You know, the GameCube was like, it could not really compete. I love the GameCube, but it could not really compete against the PlayStation 2 and the original Xbox. And then Nintendo was like, okay, cheap hardware and motion controls. How about that, suckers? And it was the biggest thing in the world, you know? And then they thought, okay, we could just do the Wii U. Let's do like a wireless tablet tied to this thing. Failed completely. But it's funny how Nintendo like looks at its decisions, even when they're wild swings, and like takes from it. Like, I don't think the Switch would have happened without them seeing how the Wii U worked, because a lot of people liked using the Wii U as just a portable console where you could have your base unit for the Wii U in your living room, but take the actual tablet to your bedroom or something and still play a game. And I think they saw that that was a use case, and that kind of led to the Switch. And now they're just like, what else can we do with this? Because I think the idea of Switch motion controls is kind of going away, right? Like, the Joy-Cons do some basic motion controls. I never liked it. The Nintendo game ARMS, you could pretend to box and play that game. It never worked well. I don't think it felt as good as it did on the Wii. So, sure, optical sensor. use your Switch thing as a mouse for different types of games, especially for like strategy RPG games. I could see it being a thing. I don't know. Krista, are you much of a Switch head? Sorry to wrap you into this conversation.
I am actually. Switch is like the only kind of console that I play. And I guess my kind of, I haven't been following the Switch too, but my big question is like, will it kind of enable these kind of like next gen games or even make other more intensive games more playable? I'm thinking specifically of Hogwarts Legacy. I bought that for Switch. It is unplayable.
Oh, it is really? Wow.
I find it unplayable.
Yeah. So, I mean, on a basic level, I think it should, Krista, because like the Switch is running a 7-year of really, really old chipset. And it's amazing that we can run what we can. Like, it's amazing the Zelda games can run on that thing. But the new one will definitely have a more modern processor. So they're saying it's compatible with most Switch games, including physical and digital games. Some titles may not work, and I'm really interested in seeing what those limitations are. But at the basic level, like, yeah, they're going to have to like let those old games take advantage of the new hardware. And also from what we're seeing, Nintendo is very pissed at seeing all the people with Switch emulators taking content and uploading it to YouTube and being like, here's Tears of the Kingdom in 4K 60 FPS. You'll never get this on Nintendo system. I do think they want people to have a better experience with these games too. So I'm hoping, we're all hoping that it's going to be much better.
I'm really hoping that OLED screen is going to be standard.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed, but I'm not sure if that's going to be real.
It's Nintendo, man. I feel like it's going to go the Steam Deck route, where Steam Deck right now, you have an OLED option. Sure, it's beautiful. You want the basic ass Steam Deck, you want something that is hundreds of dollars cheaper, you get a LCD screen. And I think a lot of people would just be fine with that.
Maybe hopefully release both at the same time. You can buy the premium option and the LCD option, especially for like young kids who are still going to be a large demographic for the Switch 2. I don't know if they care too much about OLED versus LCD, so just let them destroy something that is cheaper if they're going to destroy it.
Most definitely. And maybe we don't even know like what games will be exclusive just to the Switch 2 and won't run in the old system. They're going to have to do that because that hardware is so old. But you know what the best console is for a young child is the Switch Lite. Because that thing is tiny. It is relatively inexpensive. It plays all the games. My daughter is like, you know, fully into Mario Kart at this point, and I can play Mario Kart with her because that thing fits in her hands and she can understand how to use the control. So, I don't think we'll see like a Switch 2 Lite immediately because they love to like wait a couple of years and make you either rebuy a console or buy a companion to the console you bought, you know, recently. So we'll probably see that eventually too. But yeah, exciting. Nothing much else to say other than we'll be keeping an eye on this news, folks. And it's cool. It's kind of funny that Nintendo's just like, here's a random Thursday at 8 a.m. We're just going to drop this video. I do feel like it just felt like they were kind of responding to the leaks, that they just had to get something out. Whereas this is a whole new Nintendo console. You remember when they announced the Switch, it was like this whole video, people playing on rooftops and like introducing the concept of a portable console. This one's like, yeah, well, you know what a Switch is, guys. This is bigger. This is bigger and has bigger controllers.
They're going to have another rollout video like that at the Nintendo Direct. I think that this video really was a response to the fact that there were so many leaks, so you can't just be coy about it. Maybe if there were fewer leaks, we would only see, you know, a little bit of rumbling before the Direct in April. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't. I see people complaining that the leakers are like ruining Nintendo's launch plans. I'm like, who are you working for? Like, your job is not to secure Nintendo's product launch timeline. The leakers, journalists, everybody, like, we want to get information out there so people see it sooner. Like, that's how the world of information works. Just some real, in the gaming world, especially game fans, are just kind of wild sometimes. We will be keeping an eye on the Switch 2. Definitely let us know what you think. I have one of the, I forget which of the new consoles, like the Retroid Pocket, I think, 5. I have one of those tiny things now. There are so many different portable systems that can play a lot of old games emulated or just Android games. So this whole like ecosystem is really interesting. We saw a whole bunch of great Windows gaming portable PCs, either Windows or Steam, back at CES. So It'll be really interesting to see how the Switch 2 competes to all that. The main thing is it has Mario. It has Zelda, you know, so I guess Nintendo doesn't care that there are like a dozen other devices that do Switch-esque stuff now. I do wonder if they'll do the thing where it's like, hey, Xbox cloud streaming, Microsoft, you wanna partner up over here? Get some real cloud streaming going on, because you can cloud stream some Switch games right now. So we shall see, folks. Anything, I feel like we got to wrap, but typically we do ask you guys if you have any pop culture things you want to shout out, recommend to our audience. Krista, is there anything you've been reading, watching, listening to that you want to recommend to people? Go ahead, Ben.
So speaking of the Switch, I've been picking up my Switch a lot recently, and I feel like the Switch is saying to me, like, you haven't finished Tears of the Kingdom. Are we going to finish that? You've taken a couple of stabs at Disco Elysium. That game is basically a book. Do you want to try that again? And I'm like, I'm sorry, Switch, no. You play Balatro. And then it's like, oh my God.
You sick monster. Yeah.
Yes, Balatro is as good as people say it is. And it's also kind of interesting how this connects with another thing that we were talking about. If you find it really exciting to see number go up and like get enormous multipliers and just get like a logarithm of points all at once, go check out Balatro. Yes, it is kind of like playing card themed in the sense of like poker cards, but you don't have to use real money for this. It's a rogue light, so you will continue getting better and better and higher scores every time you play. Just go and check it out. I do think that it deserved to be in the running for Game of the Year.
Basically, it's doing what Vampire Survivors did to us a couple years ago. Number go up, you feel really powerful. I'm not a huge fan of card video games in general or poker, but it's fun. The music's good. Really nice bit of chiptunes over there in Balatro. So that's good. Let me see here. I do want to shout out Pantheon. I think I talked about it as one of those like really good AMC animated sci-fi shows that nobody saw because it was on AMC Plus. I did finish season one that's on Netflix right now. And this is good stuff, like really good science fiction. Nods to Ghost in the Shell, nods to Evangelion, nods also just like bringing up whole new ideas of artificial intelligence or how we would handle that, like uploaded intelligence, somebody uploading their brain to a digital space. It's really cool. I think the animation is good, and it's just a really well done story. So check out Pantheon. That is on Netflix right now.
Thanks everybody for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Carissa online at
Carissa B on Blue Sky, Threads, X, and Pixel Fed.
And you can find Devendra online at
I'm at Devendra everywhere. I think also Pixel Fed. I haven't posted anything there yet, but I'm also, Blue Sky is the main place I post. Check me out on the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
And you can find me on Blue Sky as well at heybellman.bluesky.social. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes because I promise you it really does help. And subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.
And here's my chat with Dan Erickson, the creator of Severance. I think we had a really good conversation about this season. Heads up, we're not spoiling anything for this season. I tried really hard not to spoil much about the first season either. So feel free to just take a listen. We talk a bit about the craft. There's some wonderful sequences in the first returning episode. And also just the idea of how he's thinking about work-life balance and the new themes that Severance is covering in season two. So here's my chat with Dan Erickson. Dan Erickson, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget Podcast.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well. This season of Severance just really gets started up and running, doesn't it? That whole sequence, which I'm sure people will get to see, I thought was like a stunning bit of direction there. But also, the entire first few episodes really seemed like you had a clear idea of where you wanted to take the show after season one. Is this pretty much the story you want to tell as you were building up season one, or have things changed, in between season one and two?
Yeah, it was more or less the same. I've always had kind of an endpoint in mind for the show. And as we were writing season one, I was starting to formulate season two in my head. But I, at the same time, when I sat down with the writers for season two, a lot of them were new. A lot of them were coming to it from the outside. And so I really wanted to get their perspective. And I asked, you know, before I even sort of told them my plan, I was like, well, what do you guys think is happening here? Mm-hmm. What do you think the company is doing? Uh-huh. Where do you think these characters should go? And a lot of them had very different ideas than I had had. And so a lot of that got worked into it, and it did sort of alter the road a little bit. But at the end of the day, the end point for this season, the final thing that we see this season was mm-hmm. always more or less where I wanted it to go. There's a you know, story development that I thought, you know, this is the season to do this. And so I knew what our North Star was.
Gotcha. I mean, that's good to hear, because I've gone through a lot of shows where it did not always seem like that was the case. So it's there's clearly like some sort of like a clear vision that you guys are adhering to, and I really appreciate that. I also want to talk about that first sequence. So that first episode is directed by Ben Stiller, who, I know has also greatly influenced the show for you guys. Producing that sequence, it's really dynamic. It's basically, you know, a character running through hallways and the camera's going every which way. Can you talk about like how much of that was practical versus like a cool digital camera effects or something there?
Yeah, I love that sequence. And of course, it's like season one, we have Mark walking through the hallways.
Yeah.
Now he's running like a madman. I think season three, he's going to be in a canoe.
On a jetpack.
Yeah. I think people... if we're ever able to show the behind the scenes of that, mm-hmm. I think people are going to be pretty surprised how much of that was practical, because a lot of it was. And of course, you know, it's sort of physically impossible to truly yeah. do that as it appears to be. And, you know, but we had this camera that was on this arm that was like whipping around Adam Scott's head, like going so fast. And, uh-huh. you know, fortunately, we had, you know, a lot of safety protocols in place to make sure that he was okay. But I was still worried. I was like, you know, I don't want him to get knocked off his feet. But it was a really, really difficult and ornate process.
You can tell I had just rewatched Run Lola Run. I'm like, whoa, real, very similar vibes here.
Yeah,
one
yeah,
of my favorite
yeah.
films. So cool to get that nod. As I was watching, I've only seen like half of the season so far, so we don't need to like dive into deep spoilers or anything. But I did think about like how you guys were producing the show. You know, Severance season one, I don't think anybody really expected what you were going to deliver there. It was a big surprise for me and a lot of the audience. You're building season two knowing that season one, you know, was kind of a success and has like taken off, and people are really like vibing with it. Has that shifted how you plan to tell the story or the kind of like narratives you want to tell with these characters?
Yeah, I think I went through a period of sophomore terror a little bit.
Yeah,
which I think and so I've talked to a lot of other people who have you know run shows or worked on shows, and most of them have said like season two is the hardest, and hopefully they weren't just saying that to make me feel better, but it was scary because you haven't yet shown that you can replicate it. You haven't yet proven that it wasn't a fluke. And, for me, I hadn't proven that to myself yet. So I was, you know, I had the imposter syndrome and everything sort of dialed up to 11 there for a while. And it wasn't until, we had a really great team of writers, and then our crew, much of whom were the same as for season one, and once those people started getting their hands on it and crafting it, and then I started to see cuts of scenes, and then ultimately of episodes, and I had this real exhale moment of like, okay, this is Severance. Like this feels like the show. I think people who loved the first season are going to love this one. And then by the end, I think there was a moment around the time we were shooting like episode seven where I was like, damn it, I think this is even better. Like, I think this is even, I actually think that we're doing the same thing, but at a higher level. And then that's when I started to get really, really excited.
Oh, yeah. I love the expanded look of the world, the new characters, too, like all the actors you guys brought in for this season. Like it's cooking. I'm really digging it. For season one, you also kind of really hit the zeitgeist, I think, where people were thinking of work-life balance when they were doing more, you know, working from home during the pandemic, the early pandemic. And kind of now part of the story of corporate America is RTO, or return to office, right? And a lot of companies are getting flack for that. It is kind of funny that you kind of hit that again in the show. There is an RTO sequence in episode 2, basically, for a lot of characters. Is that something you were just thinking of zeitgeisty either, or did it just seem true to the characters?
It's funny because you never I've given up on trying to predict
right.
what environment right. we're going to be releasing the show into, because especially, you know, we wrote season 1 before the pandemic. The big thing with this season, of course, you know, is that we had these massive strikes happening across our industry, you know, with the Writers Guild and then the actors. And I think that in a way affected or seeped its way into the story in a similar way to how the pandemic did for season 1, where the, you know, we were all just during the strike, you know, we were all talking to our guilds and having conversations about workers' rights and what we owe our employers and what we should reasonably expect back in return, and how much of ourselves and our lives and our energy we should be willing to give up for the sake of a job. And not even consciously, because again, much of the season was written before the strike, but consciously or unconsciously, I think that the tone of that, of those conversations made their way into the story. And certainly I think that they'll be on people's minds as they're watching the show. Because at the end of the day, it is a show about the rights of workers and what they deserve as human beings.
Definitely. Like, labor rights is definitely something I'm seeing talked about more heavily in pop culture in general. But you guys are really like hitting it right on here, too. Something that also was kind of covered here, the idea of somebody, basically a severed person, not having the work experience that their severed self has, and they go out and try to apply for jobs and it almost kind of works against them. That's something I didn't think about at all in season 1, but it does kind of hold true. Like, your life experience, if you kind of farm it out and just have it be a separate thing, that's not your experience. And you as a worker or as a productive person, you kind of lose that experience too. Is that something, just an idea, the idea of like a severing in general, is that something you were thinking about in season 1, or is it more of a thing you're building out for this season?
Yeah, it's one of the more insidious elements of the severance process. And it's something that came to us in conversation, is like, well, once you have severed experience, that
right.
will only apply at that workplace, you know, and so in a way it just keeps, it keeps that, you know, imbalanced, symbiotic, toxic relationship between the worker and the employer, it solidifies it even that much more.
That's true. Yeah, you can never really leave. And that I think that is becoming more and more terrifying as I watch this season. Okay, well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And looking forward to checking out the rest of the season. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was great talking to you again. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.